It is coming up on 8:32. We're going to bypass the BBC headlines in order to keep on schedule. Coming up in just a couple of minutes, Dr. Khan Slobochkov, the co-author of the just-released Communication and Community in an Animal Society. That's on A Public Affair at 8:35. And now, A Public Affair.
Good Monday morning, everybody, and welcome to A Public Affair and happy Prairie Dog Today. I'm Roger Wendell, your host this morning, and my two guests in studio are Lindsay Sterling Crank and Dr. Khan Slobochkov. Lindsay Sterling Crank is director for the Prairie Dog Coalition, environmental scientist, and has been working on prairie dog issues for the past 8 years. Dr. Khan Slobochkov is professor of biology at Northern Arizona University and best known for his research studying the prairie dog's communication system. Prairie dogs have a complex system of alarm calls and a sophisticated form of communications that borders on language. Dr. Slobochkov and co-authors Bianca Perla and Jennifer Verdolin are releasing their book today, Prairie Dogs, Communication and Community in an Animal Society. The authors believe that by examining the complex factors behind prairie dog decline, we can begin to understand the larger conservation problems inherent in our adversarial relationship with the natural world. Welcome to KGNU.
Thank you.
Thank you, Roger.
Lindsay, let's start off with you. Tell us a little bit about Prairie Dog Day.
Thanks, Roger. I'd love to. Several years ago, Terry Tempest Williams, which is a famous author several of you may have heard of, suggested that we use Groundhog Day as a way to promote the plight of the prairie dog and educational efforts around the prairie dog, and as a day to enhance our advocacy efforts. So that's exactly what we did. And over the last several years, we have been able to get several cities, Boulder being one, to declare February 2nd actually Prairie Dog Day. So depending on what our policy goals are, our educational goals are, for each year we do classroom presentations, which anybody can get a hold of by contacting the Prairie Dog Coalition. We just took 70 kids out on a field trip to a prairie dog colony on Friday. We worked in partnership with the Denver Zoological Foundation and Wild Earth Guardians to do education and outreach and policy efforts all week. So,
and great. Near the top of the hour, at the conclusion of the program, we'll give out some web addresses and contact information.
Wonderful.
But again, Prairie Dog Coalition, we appreciate you being here.
Thank you so much, Roger.
Okay, well, it sounds like the prairie dogs might be in a little bit of trouble, which is surprising to me. I've grown up in Colorado. I've lived in Aurora most of my life, and we have prairie dogs, or we did, up along Tower Road and some of those streets people might be familiar with. Seems to me prairie dogs are plentiful, but Doctor, you may not agree. Tell us about the plight of the prairie dogs. Where are they at now as we speak?
Well, prairie dogs at the moment have declined by about 98% from where they were about 100 years ago. So they're down to about 2% of their range and approximately somewhere in the ballpark of 2% of their numbers from what it was in around 1900. They're declining very rapidly for a variety of reasons. One is land development is taking up prairie dog colonies. Prairie dogs tend to have their colonies on flat ground, which is perfect for subdivisions, which is perfect for parking lots, perfect for development of all kinds. Also, prairie dogs are declining because they're being poisoned, because they're perceived to be a threat to perhaps ranching and farming interests. They're also declining because they're being shot for sport hunting. And they're also declining because of an introduced disease that was introduced in 1900 into San Francisco and has been spreading east among wildlife populations, and that's bubonic plague. Prairie dogs are very susceptible to bubonic plague. About 98 to 100% of all the prairie dogs in a colony die when they contract bubonic plague. whereas other animals such as coyotes and dogs tend to be fairly resistant to the plague. So with all of these factors, prairie dogs are declining quite a bit. Among the prairie dogs in the Flagstaff, Arizona area where I have been studying them, when I first started studying them about 25 years ago, there were lots and lots of prairie dog colonies all around Flagstaff. And now you're really hard-pressed to find any. And I think that over time, that's what's going to happen in the Boulder, Denver area, too. When I first started coming to the Boulder, Denver area 25 years ago, there were a lot more prairie dogs than there are now. And so while it looks like there are still a lot of prairie dogs, they tend to be concentrated into smaller and smaller areas, and you start losing prairie dog towns where before there used to be a bunch, now there are only a few. And so I think that unless we reverse the process very quickly, we're not going to have any prairie dogs at all around.
And Lindsay, is the Prairie Dog Coalition in agreement with this analysis? Prairie dogs are on the decline, towns are being decimated. You're nodding your head in agreement. Tell us about the state of the prairie dog from your vantage point as director of the Prairie Dog Coalition.
Definitely, Roger. We have the opportunity to work across the West in several different states of the prairie dog's range. And even in our most prestigious prairie dog colony, which is in Kanata Basin in South Dakota, it's the largest area of prairie dogs left on public land, which we define as 10,000 acres or more. Prairie dogs are in trouble. And even there, they are accompanied by the Blackfooted Ferret Reintroduction Center. And the Blackfooted Ferret is the most endangered mammal in North America. And you would think on a habitat where there's the most endangered mammal in North America, the area would be protected. But alas, the Forest Service recently proposed an amendment which would poison up to 16,000 acres of habitat there. So definitely we are in crisis across the West for prairie dogs.
And you both mentioned poisoning, and Lindsay, you mentioned South Dakota, and I recall in preparation for the program, at one time South Dakota was authorizing the recreational or competitive shooting of prairie dogs. Did I get that right?
Yes, and actually that's not just South Dakota. Colorado actually did outlaw that killing contest of prairie dogs a few years ago, but now everybody just goes up to Wyoming, so it still occurs.
Okay. 844 is the time. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to A Public Affair. I'm Roger Wendell. We have two guests this morning. We're talking about prairie dogs and Prairie Dog Day. Lindsay Sterling Crank is director of the Prairie Dog Coalition, and Dr. Khan Slobotchkov, I'll get that right, co-author of Prairie Dogs, Communication and Community in an Animal Society. Doctor, if we could back up a couple of million years maybe, tell us about the prehistory or the ancient history of prairie dogs. Where do they come from? Where have they gone? How many species do we have today as a result? And what is their range? Give us the big picture, if you would.
Okay, the big picture is that prairie dogs are related to ground squirrels. They're in the ground squirrel family. And the ground squirrel family showed up about 30 million years ago in an evolutionary sense. Now, prairie dogs started showing up probably roughly about 10 million years ago based on the fossil evidence. And we now have five living species out of those species that in the past evolved. The oldest living species is the Gunnison's prairie dog, which is found in western Colorado. That showed up in the fossil record about 750,000 years ago. The blacktail species, which is found in eastern Colorado, showed up in the fossil record relatively recently, about between 75,000 and 10,000 years ago. But there are currently five species of prairie dogs. There's the blacktail, which is found in the western plains states. That one has the broadest distribution from Canada to northern Mexico. Then there's the Gunnison prairie dog, which is found in western Colorado and in northern Arizona, a little bit in Utah. There's the white-tailed prairie dog, which is found in western Colorado, northwestern Colorado, and Wyoming. There's the Utah prairie dog, which now is highly imperiled. It's listed as a threatened species, and it's found in southwestern Utah. And there is the Mexican prairie dog, which is also highly imperiled, which is listed as an endangered species, which is found in small pockets in north central Mexico.
As I mentioned earlier, growing up in Aurora, I would often see prairie dogs actually crossing Alameda and Tower Road and some of the streets out there. But can you describe for us, you know, in more official terms, how do prairie dogs actually live when they're not being interrupted with streets and developments? What's a coterie and what is their colony like?
They live in towns or colonies. And in the past, the colonies used to have hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of individuals. Now the colonies are much more constrained, so that we have maybe in most typical colonies 100 to 200 individuals. Within those colonies, they split up the land into territories, or some people call them coteries. And we used to think that these coteries were family groups of individuals who are all related to each other. Now we know from DNA genetic studies that they're essentially groups of friends who cooperate together in defending their territory. So the territories are kind of like suburban living, where you have a suburb, and then each house in the suburb has a certain territory that the homeowners defend against their neighbors' encroachment. And So you have these individuals who live there, and the reason we think that the territories are so important is that the territories offer the prairie dogs their food supply, which is grass and other plant vegetation. And also the territories offer the prairie dogs a burrow system, which is very important for the survival of the prairie dogs, because it offers an equitable habitat to get away from bad weather, and also offers a place of refuge for the prairie dogs when they encounter predators. And the burrows actually have an important ecological component to them, because what the burrows do is they allow water to percolate through to aquifers. And since water in the West is increasingly a big issue, the water percolation is something that the prairie dogs really contribute a lot to the ecological system about. And also, by burrowing and turning up the soil, they help aerate the soil, which allows prairie plants to grow much better.
And something I've noticed or witnessed a couple of times over the years in Aurora and even in Boulder and Longmont is prairie dog relocation. When people like myself are complaining about Tower Road wiping out a colony, I've seen different groups over the years come in and attempt to relocate prairie dogs. Lindsay, maybe you could comment on that. I know maybe the Prairie Dog Coalition isn't involved directly with that, but what can you tell us about relocating? Is it a good idea? Is it successful? Does it work?
Prairie dog relocation can definitely be successful, and it's definitely a good non-lethal management option. However, it's not the answer to solving our problems. It's more of a short-term solution. What would be a better answer for our issues with the prairie dogs is to protect them where they are, which is, you know, again, what we're doing about Prairie Dog Day. So many people say, like you do, there's so many of them, is there really an issue? But obviously we're using this day as some education to say, hey, look, they actually have declined by 98%. They are a keystone species of the ecosystem, and we do need to come together as a community to figure out what we can do to coexist together. And relocation is a viable option. It's just not the answer.
And again, what does that keystone species actually mean? Give us an idea.
Well, in short, there's 9 different species of wildlife that directly depend on prairie dog populations for survival. So the black-footed ferret we mentioned earlier completely depends on prairie dogs as its food source. Several different predators depend on prairie dogs for their food source, and several different other species live in the prairie dog burrows. So just like there's one keystone in an arch, which we often refer to, if you were to take that stone out, the system would fall apart, the arch would fall apart, and the prairie dog plays that role in our Great Plains ecosystem.
Okay. Dr. Slobotchkov, I'd like to ask you about this issue about grass and what the prairie dogs eat. You mentioned it briefly, but where I'm going with this is there much competition, say, with the bison 200 years ago as far as this grass eating and whatever the prairie dogs normally eat, and maybe competition today with cattle?
As far as people can tell, there was no competition between bison and prairie dogs. There were, in the historical past, about 5 billion prairie dogs, and there were lots and lots of bison, and they coexisted very nicely.
That's 5 billion with a B.
5 billion with a B.
Okay.
We're at a much lower number now. So there seemed to be no competition, even though prairie dogs and bison seem to feed on similar kinds of grass. Now, as far as competition with prairie dogs and cattle, there is a perception that prairie dogs and cows do compete for food. And this is the reason why there were, in historical times, poisoning campaigns to get rid of the prairie dogs. But the issue of whether there actually is competition between cows and prairie dogs is a little bit unclear. There have been very few studies that have looked at that. One study actually showed that cows gain weight when they are together in a paddock with prairie dogs.
That's counterintuitive. Why would they gain weight?
Well, they would gain weight because what the prairie dogs do is they clip the vegetation, and by clipping the vegetation, it causes the vegetation to resprout. And as the vegetation resprouts, it resprouts with tender shoots that are full of nutrients. And those nutrients actually can be assimilated by the cows much better than the older leaves, which are full of silicaceous types of material that are hard for the cows to digest. So that was one study. Another study showed that when you had a lot of prairie dogs in the same paddock with cows, the value of each cow dropped by about roughly 5%. So we're talking about losing about $14 or something like that out of a cow that might sell for $500.
And in my unscientific survey in preparation for the program this morning, I spoke with a couple of ranchers, local ranchers in northern Colorado. I just happened to be up there and asked them what they thought about prairie dogs. One was adamant. He suggested that prairie dogs, prairie dog colonies and holes break the legs of his horses and his cows. And I said, well, how often does that happen? Well, it hasn't happened yet, but it's a threat. Can you tell us about this idea that prairie dog holes are a hazard to cattle, horses, maybe mountain bikers? I don't know.
I keep hearing this all the time. People mention to me that their cows or horses are constantly breaking legs in prairie dog burrows and have to be put down. And I keep trying to find an instance where somebody's actual horse or cow broke a leg. And it's always, well, it wasn't my horse, but I have a friend whose cousin had a brother whose horse broke a leg.
Certainly.
And I've never actually been able to track down any real person whose actual horse or cow broke a leg. So I'm thinking that this is probably just a rural myth. Now, that's not to say that if you deliberately make your horse gallop through a prairie dog town, maybe the horse might break a leg. But if the horse is left on its own, horses are pretty smart about these things, and they have really good vision. They're not going to go break a leg, I don't think.
Okay. Now to the central thesis of your book, Prairie Dogs, Communication and Community in an Animal Society, Communications. This morning I rode my bicycle into the studio along the Boulder Creek Trail here in Boulder, if folks are familiar with that, and it intersects a prairie dog colony probably just a kilometer east of the station here. The prairie dogs, to me, almost seem like they know me at this point. They're, at one time, they seem to be excited. Now, when I ride my bicycle through, they almost ignore me, and you're nodding your head in agreement. What I also noticed, though, one day I attempted to photograph them, so I got off of my bicycle, they scurried, they barked, they did all kinds of strange things. They like the idea of me just passing through without stopping. What can you tell us about these behaviors and these communications between prairie dogs, especially just east of the station here?
Well, let me preface this by saying that our studies have shown that prairie dogs have the most sophisticated animal language that's been decoded so far, more sophisticated than whales and dolphins, more sophisticated than chimps and other primates. They have a system of alarm calls, and within those alarm calls, they can incorporate information about the species of predator, like coyote versus domestic dog, like red-tailed hawk, and so on. And they can describe the physical features, like the color of clothes that humans are wearing, the size and shape of the humans, the size and shape of coyotes, and so on. This is far more sophisticated than anything that we've found in other animals to date. Now, to go on to what you're talking about, in our experience, prairie dogs actually do get used to people. and they get used to individual people. You know, if they can describe the color of clothes that you're wearing and something about the size and shape of you, chances are they can probably remember who you are as an individual.
And these descriptions are a sequence of barks of some sort, or yips, as you describe in the book.
Right. They're a sequence of yips, and they incorporate this as changing tones into their barks. So if, say, you're wearing a green shirt, they would have a slight change in tone in their call for you as a tall, thinner human. And if you're wearing a blue shirt, then they would modify their call to take that into account too. And we've also found that they can describe objects that they've never seen before, like predators that they've never seen before, like geometric shapes that they've never seen before. So they probably have a description of you and your bicycle. We found, for example, that when we have a person walking a dog on a leash, they combine parts of a human call and parts of a dog call to make it into something that is more like human walking dog.
And what I gathered from the book is there is a substantial difference in the way they respond to, say, a hawk flying above and maybe a coyote, if you could describe those differences.
Sure. When they see a coyote, they all run to the lip of their burrows and stand on the lip of their burrows, and other animals who are below ground all come up to watch the coyote. So you might have been looking at 10 prairie dogs before the coyote call sounded, and suddenly you've got 100 prairie dogs all standing at the lips of their burrows. Now, when a hawk is diving, they give a hawk call, and only the individuals who are in the direct flight path of the hawk run to the lips of their burrows, and everybody else sort of stands up on their tiptoes to see if Joe got nailed by the hawk.
Okay, we're just about out of time. Let's take an opportunity here to discuss a little contact information, maybe give listeners an idea of how they can not only learn more about prairie dogs, but what they can do to help protect them. Lindsay, we'll start with you.
Sure. If anybody's interested in what they can do to help protect the prairie dogs, the best thing to do is to let your legislators know that you think prairie dogs are worthy of protections and that this is an important issue to you. Aside from that, if there's any teachers or leaders out there of children's organizations, we would love to bring a prairie ecosystem presentation into your classroom free of charge, and it is all based on Colorado state standards. We'd also love to invite you to be a part of Prairie Dog Day at the Denver Zoo next year. You can find out more information about all of these things at www.prairiedogcoalition.org or 720-938-0788.
Dr. Slobochkov, what can you tell us about things listeners can do to learn more to protect prairie dogs? Your parting comments.
Well, one of the things that listeners could do is they could buy our book, where we have a lot of information about prairie dogs. The other thing is that if they want to learn about some of the language studies, they can go to the website www.animallanguageinstitute.org. This is an animal language institute that we've set up to explore communication not only in prairie dogs, but also the possibility of communication in a lot of other animal species as well. And they can contact me through that institute, or they can contact me through Lindsay and the Prairie Dog Coalition. Lindsay, I'm sure, would be happy to forward any emails to me.
Of course.
Okay. I want to thank you both for appearing on KGNU and A Public Affair.
Thank you so much, Roger.
Okay. You've been listening to A Public Affair. I'm Roger Wendell. My guests have been Lindsay Sterling Crank, director of the Prairie Dog Coalition, and Dr. Khan Slobochkov, a professor of biology at Northern Arizona University. And we've been talking about the book he's co-authored, Prairie Dogs, Communication and Community in an Animal Society. Thank you for listening to your community radio station, KGNU. This is KGNU Boulder, 88.5 FM, and KGNU Denver, 1390 AM. I'm Roger Wendell. Up next is Counterspin.